had just calculated the expression for the superconducting gap at t equals zero in the ground state of a BCS superconductor, and I wrote that expression again, so you can see the assumption here is that we are in weak coupling. Weak coupling means that the interaction constant times the density of states is small compared to 1, so e to the minus 1 over a small number is a small number, and the scale is set by the phonon frequency that mediates the interaction. So that's the gap at t equals 0. Now, we can go further than that for t greater than 0. And delta, of course, not equal to 0. So we had this expression, the self-consistent equation. Over 2. Okay, and so you can see how this so that's actually the equation for the gap as a function of temperature. So basically the temperature enters here in this beta. The gap is a function of temperature. The cutoff frequency obviously isn't, nor is the density of states. So you can solve this equation numerically to get delta of t, but it's not so easy to just do it analytically on the blackboard. But there's one other limit that we can solve this in, and that is as t goes to tc, in other words, if you increase the temperature, the gap gets smaller, you'll see, or you could see easily by just doing it yourself. And at a certain temperature, it vanishes. And then what you have is just your normal Fermi liquid. So there's some temperature below which the system is superconducting, above which it's a normal metal. Okay, and we can calculate that temperature simply by noting that delta is going to go to 0 there. And so we can assume that delta is 0, but, you know, like infinitesimally positive. And then this expression here becomes 1 over n of 0 v is equal to, so what have we got? 0 to omega to pi, tanh, let's write this as epsilon over 2tc, d epsilon over epsilon. That's right. So you can almost do that integral in your head. Not quite, though. So what does this integral look like? Oh, yeah. D epsilon over epsilon. Oh, I see. Yes. So the question is, what does the integrand look like? And if you look at this thing here, you can see that for large epsilon, the tanh is 1. And so you just have d epsilon over epsilon. And for small epsilon, the tanh is linear. And so then the epsilons cancel, and you just have d epsilon over 2tc. Right? Yeah. I see. So that's what's wrong with my notes. I have 2tc rather than. So the integrand if this is 1 over 2tc, and this is 2tc, you can see that if it weren't for the tanh, this thing would be diverging. And above 2tc, it just looks like 1 over epsilon, really. But below TC, 2TC, it sort of goes up to this constant like that. So if you wanted to do a crude approximation to this integral, you could say that this is approximately equal to this integral from 2TC to omega to pi is just log omega to pi over 2tc plus this part of the integral is just going to be some constant, which turns out to be about 0.82. And so the conclusion is that TC is like this, 1.13 omega to pi e to the minus 1 over n of 0 phi. That's what the numbers work out. And you can check that yourself with your Mathematica program. And so then this gives the weak coupling BCS result, which is that 2 delta of 0 is approximately 3.5 TC. And so if you like, you can look at a lot of different materials which you think, well, you can look at a lot of different materials and calculate this ratio of 2 delta over TC, and it'll be some number like 3.5 for the weak coupling ones, and then as you go away from weak coupling, maybe to stronger coupling, it will deviate from this result. Yeah.
So the expression for delta at t equals to 0.
At the first this one, right? Yes.
This has like this looks like one of these formula from field theory, which is instanton kind of, you know, non-perturbative correction. Where you have some e to the power minus 1 over t squared.
Right, right.
Or something like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there like an analogy with
that? Yeah, I don't know that much about instantons, to be honest, but this is sort of your classic. Well, for one thing, is that expression appropriate for small g squared?
No, actually, that's appropriate for large g squared.
You sure? So e to the minus 1 over g squared?
Right.
So, but then normally, why would you write it that way? Because if g squared was large,
right,
you would just expand it.
I see. Right.
You see what I mean? So normally, an expression like this is what you write when the coupling is weak.
Right.
Are you sure it isn't weak coupling because there's some kind of like duality or something like that?
Okay, I'll have to check.
Yeah, you should check that, because typically then you just write, if G is a large 1 over G squared perturbation parameter, you just write something plus 1 over G squared correction. So, yeah. Okay. Okay, so finally, then, if I've done this right, if you were to plot 2 delta of t over 3.5 tc versus t over tc, then it would go from 1 to 1, like that. Well, let's move 1 a bit. Okay. And I would just make 2 comments here, that this is delta in here. You have delta goes like tc minus t to some exponent, which maybe they'll calculate. Should they calculate beta?
Tomorrow?
Yeah. So this, you'll go look at this in a tutorial. So I won't give away the big secret of what this exponent is. It's so much more fun to calculate it. And here, basically, this looks like 1 minus something times e to the minus delta over t. I think it's delta. Is it delta or 2 delta? That's embarrassing. I can't remember. It's either delta or 2 delta. Yeah. But we should just look that up. Can we calculate that? Well, let's not bother. Okay. Anyway, we'll find out. And this gap actually in all of the theory of phase transitions, more often than not, or almost always, have something called an order parameter. An order parameter is something that tells you if it's 0, you're not in the ordered state, and if it's not 0, you are in the ordered state. Okay, so it's like either or. And the order here is the existence of non-zero pairing correlations. In other words, that the average of, say, the C dagger K, C dagger minus K is not zero. That's equivalent to saying that you have a non-zero gap. Okay, and that vanishes continuously, which it doesn't have to. You know, there's lots of phase transitions where things change discontinuously, but this isn't one of them. So that vanishes continuously at the critical temperature above which you have a normal Fermi liquid. Okay? So that's something that you'll look at. Yeah?
What's the importance of twice per gap?
It's the cost of breaking the Cooper pair, because that creates 2 excitations. Okay? So to create a single one of these fermionic gamma quasi particles costs you delta, and I'm actually to break that, you know, gives you 2 of them, so that's 2 delta. Okay, and I think that this might be delta, but I'm not sure for some reason. But like in the optical spectra, where you know, the conductivity of a superconductor is infinite at 0 frequency, and then it's 0 for frequencies between 0 and 2 delta. And that's because the first absorptive type process that you can have at finite frequency is when the photon basically breaks a super pair.
But here, I don't know why, I just in the back of my mind.
So melt is on the piercing specific heat of the...
You bet.
That's at low temperatures. It's that, yeah. And I think that's right. I think that's right. Okay. Okay. So actually, we're finished with BCS theory for the moment. So now, so the rest of the course is going to be devoted to unconventional metals and superconductors. And I'm going to start off rather gently by writing down a model Hamiltonian, which I'll call the, well, which is called the extended Hubbard model. And the extended Hubbard model is a Hamiltonian that's defined on a lattice. And actually, all of the discussion for a long time, or probably to the end of the course, is going to be on a two-dimensional square lattice, because there will be many references to the high-temperature, the copper oxide superconductors. Okay. So this is your extended Hubbard model. So it has hopping. And then there's this term which refers to a single site. And OK, so already what I've put in here is that every site on the lattice, I plus delta and so forth, and there the idea is that this is a square lattice, has a single orbital, a single electronic orbital that the electrons are hopping between. And if there was more than one orbital that mattered, that the electrons were hopping between, I'd have to put an extra index here to say which orbital the electrons hopping from and to. But I'm not doing that, so it's like one orbital per atom. And that's because maybe, it might be the orbitals might arise from some atomic multiplet, like, say, d orbitals, but it could be that several of them that are occupied are split off because of crystal field effects, and the highest occupied one is the only one that's partially occupied that the electrons hop between. Or you could imagine, you know, every atom is like a hydrogen atom or an alkali metal atom, which has a single s orbital that you hop between. Whatever. It's a model. Okay? So this U, which looks like this, refers to what happens if there are two electrons on in that orbital. Okay? And if there are two electrons in that orbital, they have to be in a singlet state. So we write that as one's up, one's down. Okay? And so that's... Now, actually, what I've written so far is the Hubbard model. That's it. And it's a very interesting, highly non-trivial model. Countless theorists have been beating on it for a long time. Okay. So, but then I want to add another term to extend it. And this represents the interaction between electrons in orbitals on neighboring sites. Okay? So that's like the new little piece of business. So this is extended. These are nearest neighbor interactions. So no big deal. In fact, if you look at what this interaction is telling you, for instance, you could write Ni equals Ni up plus Ni down. And except for the fact that I've sort of commuted this guy through, this is like, if you sum over alpha, it's the number of electrons on site I. And if you sum over beta, it's the number of electrons on site I plus delta. So you can see that that interaction, if it just goes like Ni, Ni plus delta, well, that can equal 0 if both or one of the sites is empty. That can equal 1 if both sites are equally, if both sites have one electron, both sites have one electron. It can equal 2 if one site has two electrons, the other site has one electron. And it can equal 4 if both sites are doubly occupied. Okay, so that's what Ni, Ni plus delta could be. So now, let's just consider V equals 0, which is just your normal Hubbard model. And I just want to make three observations, very simple ones. One is, U less than 0 gives you superconductivity. Singlet, S-wave singlet. So that's actually a very simple model that can give rise to superconductivity. If you just have a U that's attractive on site, you get that kind of Cooper pairing. Okay. That's one statement. Statement two, even more trivial case, is if U is 0 and you have one electron per site. Actually, if U is 0 and you have any number of electrons per site, you have a metal, a band metal. And in particular, for this case here, this is a half-filled band metal. And I keep wanting to say that it's a good metal. Okay? Because you've got this band, it's half filled, and it's easy for the electrons to move around. Okay? You've got a nice density of states of the Fermi energy and so forth. Okay. This is actually a trivial statement. Slightly less trivial is that if U is much larger than T and one electron per site, then you have what's called a Mott insulator. What does it mean that it's a Mott insulator? It means that basically because U is large, the electrons would like a ground state in which each one is localized on a site. And in order for any of them to move, one electron has to move from its site and doubly occupy a neighboring site. And that costs you U. And if U is large, then that doesn't want to happen. Okay. So more generally speaking, well, no, that's it. That's the bottom line. So if U is large, so the potential energy is large compared to the kinetic energy term, and you have one electron per site, then the ground state is an insulator, one electron per site. Okay. Now, you might want to say, well, I don't know. What would you say about that? Is that a well-defined ground state? Okay, so I told you where all the electrons are, but I haven't said anything about their spin. Okay, and if you make a ground state where you put one electron per site, that electron can be up or down. And so this state that I've just described to you is 2 to the n fold spin degenerate. Okay, so this is a highly degenerate ground state. Now, you might ask yourself the question, is there anything that then decides? Because these are all the really interesting problems in physics, which is where you have these massively degenerate states in, you know, sort of first order. And then the residual interactions decide how those states mix and what your real ground state is. Okay, so the question you might want to ask yourself is, I put one electron per site, I've got this 2 to the n fold degenerate state. Is there anything that decides how that degeneracy gets resolved? Or is there some, I mean, another way of saying it is there some arrangement of those spins which is better than many of the other arrangements? Okay, so let's look at that. So let's look at some spins. So here's some sites. And let's say this is, make the spins green. Up, down, up, down. And this guy will make down, down, up, up. Yes?
What happens for the value of U between 0 and T?
So if U is between 0 and T, or some number, then it's a, you could do like Hartree-Fock. Say that U is repulsive so that it doesn't become superconducting. And then you could do Hartree-Fock and you can say, well, the dispersion will be slightly modified and so forth. You know, it all comes out. So it'll be a Fermi liquid type thing. Okay. And so there's some kind of phase transition, if you like. Delocalized and localized. Okay. So now, let's ask ourselves, okay, let's do perturbation theory in this degenerate manifold. Let's say, for instance, I mean, the, oh, so, okay, so let's go back here. So here's our Hubbard model, and it's got two terms in it. It's got U and it's got T. Normally, we diagonalize T and use that to define our basis states. But we haven't done that here. We've ignored T completely, and we just classified our states according to U. And if you like, this is the manifold where U is 0, where this term gives you 0 because everything's singly occupied. So now we want to say, okay, but what is the effect of this kinetic energy term? And the effect of the kinetic energy term, if you think in terms of perturbation theory, is that you can hop, but it costs you some energy U when you hop. So if you think it like in second order perturbation theory, one of these guys can hop onto a site and then back. And that's a process that's like T squared over U. Okay, the hopping is the T and back, and the U is the energy cost. So the point is that can only happen if these guys are in different spin states, because then you put two spins on the same site. So we'll call this yes, that can happen. But on the other hand, these two guys cannot do that. Okay? So the ability of the electrons to gain some benefit from the kinetic energy term depends on whether the spins on neighboring sites are in the same spin state or in a relative singlet state, if they're like in a relative triplet or singlet state. Okay. So I mean, that right away tells you what you'd like to have for your ground state. What you'd like to have for your ground state is every spin which is down should be surrounded by sites where the spin is up, and vice versa. Because then, virtually, these things can just be hopping back and forth, even though their expectation value is one electron per site. They can be virtually hopping back and forth and getting a contribution from the kinetic energy. But that only works if they're all antiparallel, and that's called antiferromagnetism. So let's look at this energy a little bit more closely. So let's just consider two sites. Okay. So the energy, well, so the point is that you can pick up, if you just look at a pair of sites, you can lower your energy by minus 4t squared over u if the spins are in a singlet state, and you can't if they're in a triplet state. And you can write this expression for the energy in terms of spin operators, delta E, which is 4t squared over u. And you can write it like this. And where s1 plus s2 squared equals 2 for and it's 0 okay, I mean it's like the the magnitude of the total spin, when the total spin is 1, is 1 times 2, which is 2. And so you can see, the way I've written this, this is 0 if the total spin is 1, and it's minus 1 if the total spin is 0. Yeah?
When the electron hops sites, does that lower the energy?
In second order perturbation theory, the fact that, so if you look at this as a as a 2 to the n degenerate manifold, okay, and there's no diagonal perturbation, so if you just look at this. There's no diagonal perturbation. It's only in second order perturbation theory that you start to split these things. So this thing will split. Okay. And the one at the top is the ferromagnetic state where all the spins are parallel, and nobody can do anything in second order perturbation theory. And the one at the bottom is the antiferromagnetic state where basically electrons on any site can, you have these non-zero matrix elements where they hop and then come back, and that lowers you by, and the 4 you have to work out for yourself.
Okay. So it's just the potential ability.
Right, yeah. They're not completely, you know, so basically what you're doing is you're mixing in states up here at U. Okay, so all of these states here are interacting with states where you have one double occupied site. Okay, and actually, I guess I've drawn it wrong. That's probably why Michael's eyebrows went up. Probably more like that. Yeah, right. Just like I said here, where I had a 0 there. Right, ferromagnetic state doesn't go up. Okay. So things can just go down in second order perturbation theory. Okay. Just checking. okay. Yeah.
I have a stupid question.
Sure. That's when they're parallel. They're, it's like triplet is up or down or up down plus down up, which is also the rest of the triplet. So basically what I've said is that if you have two sites, there's a spin-dependent lowering of the ground state energy, which I've written in this way, where these are spin operators for spin-half objects. And so if I then go on and multiply this out, this is equal to, 2t squared over u. And then I've got S1 squared plus S2 squared minus or plus 2S1 dot S2 minus 2. Okay. And the square of a spin half operator is just 3/4. So you've got 3/2 minus 2 is minus 1/2. And then you've got 2S1 dot S2. So basically what this is 4t squared over u times S1 dot S2 minus 1/4. Okay? So basically what this is saying is that it's as if you had a spin-dependent interaction between the electrons that was of the form S dot S. And this coupling constant is usually called J. It's the exchange interaction constant. And so the spin-dependent interaction is such that the spins like to be anti-parallel for the pair. Now, I should just mention that there's a beautiful problem in Ashcroft and Merman which is the Hubbard model for the hydrogen atom. It's basically this model for two sites. And you can, you go through essentially all of this. And that's an exactly solvable problem. Okay. So, what's the bottom line? For positive U, the Hubbard model gives rise to an effective antiferromagnetic nearest neighbor exchange interaction. Okay. Now, this is all a little bit fluffy because everything that we've said corresponds to just two sites. So you might ask yourself the question, okay, can I start with this Hamiltonian and derive an effective Hamiltonian for the whole lattice, if you like? And not only that, can I derive an effective Hamiltonian which isn't just only for the case of one electron per site, but also works if you remove a few electrons and you have some holes. Okay, if you remove a few electrons and have some holes, all of a sudden things can actually move around. But on the other hand, if there aren't very many of them, then it has to be similar to having no holes at all. So this like antiferromagnetic tendency has to still be there. So let's talk about that. Let's call it a lattice. So less than or equal to one electron per site. And the reference for what I'm going to say now is the web lectures of Jonathan Keeling, of Cambridge. On quantum magnetism. And there's a link to this on the wiki. So let me just tell you the answer. Okay, the answer is what's called the TJ model or TJ Hamiltonian. And that's equal to minus T, the sum over I delta and alpha, with this prime here that's ominous prime, which has deep consequences. Where SI is just okay, so These are the Pauli matrices, 2x2 Pauli matrices, and so you can just sum over spin states, and you get some complicated combination of quadratic and C dagger. Okay, so that's the spin operator for fermions on a lattice. And so the question is, what does the prime mean? Okay, this is an effective Hamiltonian. This is effective Hamiltonian says there's an effective anti-ferromagnetic coupling between spins on nearest neighbor sites. But it's also an effective Hamiltonian in the sense that it's restricted to the manifold of no double occupancy. Okay. So if you're only interested in the low-lying states of the system, the electrons can hop around if there's some holes, or they can't, but their spins feel this effective coupling. So the spins feel this effective coupling, and they can hop around if there's any space to hop. In other words, if there are some missing electrons. But the effective Hamiltonian is restricted to the manifold where an electron never hops onto a site which is already occupied. Okay? So that's like already a horrendous problem, just that hopping, because basically built into this has to be the knowledge of where all the other electrons are. So it's like the U equals infinity limit, which is basically what we're doing. We're looking at the manifold of states where'd it go? Oh, that picture went, but where the U equals the doubly occupied states are treated as being up at infinity. Yes, Sebastian.
J is
4t squared over U, essentially.
No, you did use J. You just
said where's J?
In that sum.
Oh, sorry. J is I can spell.
It would be NIN.
Yeah. NI plus delta, sorry, right. Sorry. So the question is, how do you derive this? I should say right away that if you like, this is like a perturbation. This effective Hamiltonian is already like a perturbation expansion in T squared over U, and there are actually other terms of order T squared over U which I've neglected, which you can easily calculate. Okay, the other terms of order T squared over U are terms that involve three sites. And basically what they say is that hopping from one site to a neighbor, that amplitude is affected by whether or not the neighboring sites are occupied or empty. Okay, so that's a three-site term, which makes the Hamiltonian more complicated, but it's complicated in a way that you can calculate. And I just haven't written them here. So how would you derive this effective Hamiltonian? And I encourage you to look at these notes and see how it's done, but I'll just sketch it for you. So the way you want to think of this is that the Hubbard model, I see I've written it the wrong way in the notes, has a, so basically what we're doing is we're classifying states by HU. How many are doubly occupied? That's the biggest energy in the problem. And then the hopping, T, has some diagonal terms and some off-diagonal terms. And by diagonal and off-diagonal, I mean diagonal and off-diagonal in U. Okay, so this takes you between states that have the same number of doubly occupied sites, and this takes you between states that have different numbers of doubly occupied sites. So this guy here, for instance, like this, you can think of it as hopping of holes, that this whole unoccupied site and this occupied site goes to where the hole is moved to the right. Or similarly, the picture here is that you classify your manifolds of states as being the states with no double occupied sites, one doubly occupied site, two doubly occupied sites, and so forth. So this is more general than, in the end, we'll look at the effect of Hamiltonian in the space of no doubly occupied sites, and that's the TJ Hamiltonian. But this is just a question of how you would derive that. Okay. So this has terms like or like that. So that's what the off-diagonal part would do. It would change the number of doubly occupied sites. And so one way of deriving the TJ Hamiltonian is to use this trick that you used to derive the effect of attractive interaction due to the electron-phonon coupling. Okay? So if you calculate a transformed Hamiltonian, which is of the form e to the is, hu plus ht diagonal plus ht off diagonal, e to the minus is. And if you expand this out in powers of s, So you get hu, it's the biggest term, and then you get I commutator of s with hu plus the diagonal hopping term plus off diagonal plus I times S with HTD plus HTOD plus or minus, actually, other things. So where I've tried to arrange these in order of increasing powers of T over U. Okay, so this has U. This thing I'll show in a second is of order T. As are these. And these things here will be of order t squared over u, and I guess this thing here will be of order t squared over u, and you can keep going. So let's just show that. Okay. So the trick is to choose this transformation so that these two terms cancel. Okay, so we choose S so that okay. And I won't go any further in this except to say that this then requires that S be of order T over U. In order for that to cancel. And that's basically it. So so if you then restrict yourself to the manifold in which the eigenvalue of HU is 0, or the expectation value of HU is 0, then you have a effective Hamiltonian, which is this plus this, I guess, yeah. Okay. And you can fill in or read those notes and fill in the steps. Okay. And actually, this will also, so am I missing something here? I guess it's this term. This will also give you, this then becomes t squared over u. Yeah, so you've got all of these terms here. This will also give you these three site terms that I told you about. Okay, so it'll give you the TJ Hamiltonian that I've written down and the three site terms. Okay. So that's just to indicate how that comes about, or one way of that can come about. But we should just go on now and continue talking about unconventional superconductivity. Michael, is there some, are you trying to see your way through to the end of this calculation? Well, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a term of order T that allows the whole.
That's right.
And that's not removed by this
calculation. No. And that's like the sum over, that's like the first term in the TJ Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
It's basically the hopping of holes. If you treat that as the hopping of holes, then that's where, even though you have holes, that's HOD would be something that basically hopped an electron onto an already occupied site. It's the off diagonal in U. U, exactly. Yeah, it gives you extra U. And so that's yeah, okay, good. Okay, so what's the bottom line here? The bottom line is that even with the on-site Hubbard model, there are effective, attractive interactions between electrons on neighboring sites, which can give rise to superconductivity. Okay, so so that's just for the Hubbard model. And all of this, so therefore, so that's what I want to say. Nearest neighbor attractive interaction from Hubbard. Without extending it. And so that suggests that we should consider the problem of superconductivity where there's a pairing Hamiltonian that looks like this. So this suggests okay, so the point is that it's worth considering how pairing happens when you have attractive nearest neighbor interactions. Up till now, we've just looked at the effectively what happens when you have attractive on-site interactions. And this will give rise to slightly more exotic kinds of superconductivity. You may find it unsatisfying that the which I've erased the TJ Hamiltonian, that the TJ Hamiltonian is actually a rather exotic Hamiltonian, which really has to do with the hopping of holes. And in this picture here, you're looking at effectively superconductivity. Well, it's not okay. It's, I mean, in a sense, the TJ model just suggests that you should look at the case where you have attractive nearest neighbor interactions between electrons. But the TJ model is a complicated model. But in any case, we can consider this kind of superconductivity. I guess that's where we'll start next time, and consider what kind of superconductivity you can get out of this pairing Hamiltonian. Okay. Oh, was I supposed to? Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, the homework.
The homework.